Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Scout Smith, and this is Down South and Dirty with Scout Smith. Today we're going to be talking about Edward Snowden and Bo Bergdahl. Are they heroes or are they traitors? And today as my guest host, I have Jim Peterson, a general partner at Advantage Tactical Systems, LLC in Franklin, Georgia. Hi, Jim. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Scout. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Well, first of all, give my guest a little, you know, give yourself a little plug for Advantage Tactical Systems. Tell us about what you guys are doing up there in Franklin, Georgia.
Okay. Well, Advantage Tactical Company is, we're a training school and an outdoor range. We have a 90-acre site in Franklin, Georgia, and we do mostly training for personal defense. We also do law enforcement training, handgun training, things like that, and we do competitive sports shooting events once a month, sometimes twice a month out there. But it's a great facility open to the general public. We do all kinds of training, and I welcome to go check out our website at advantagega.com or look us up on Facebook, Advantage Tactical Company in Franklin.
Well, hey, I haven't had a chance to come up there, and I told you guys I was going to come up there and visit y'all. I'm going to come out there up that way soon and visit you. But you know, me and you've had this ongoing, you know, Facebook relationship where we do a lot of debating.
Yes,
and,
we do.
And over the last couple of years, we've had a couple of really good ones. But here lately, we've been really on this subject that we're talking about today. And I think a lot of people in America, and particularly down in the South from what I'm gathering, and I guess because, you know, as Southerners, you know, we take our political situations a little bit more seriously, I think, than people in other parts of the country. But, you know, that's my opinion. You know, Northerners and West Coasters may think a little bit different. But Edward Snowden and Bo Bergdahl, you know, those two names resonate across the American political spectrum right now when you get to talking about heroes and traitors, because everybody has that different set on those two guys. So I'm going to jump right on in, and we're going to talk about the one that right now is really, you know, got everybody angst, you know, up, and that's Bo Bergdahl. I'm going to let you have the first shot at this and tell me what you think about this situation.
Well, on this situation, I think it was a bad move all the way around. I don't think we should have made the trade, and I definitely think, without a doubt, I would say the evidence adds up to, at the very least, he deserted his post. And if you go from there, it just goes downhill from that point. We've had plenty of soldiers that died searching for him, soldiers that were wounded. It just changed everybody's life forever. And to go ahead and make the trade on top of that, and I'm sure you've heard this echoed on other, you know, news sites, but to make the trade on top of that is just adding insult to injury, I think, to, everybody that served honorably.
Well, you know, as you know, there's been some controversy about that, whether or not he deserved it or not. There's been this, you know, when Bo first got captured, he said that he got lost while he was on patrol. We've also heard that, you know, that he's left the post before. I've read that. And a lot of people are saying that, you know, he didn't desert. He was either left behind or he just happened to, he did an ASCAP move, excuse my language, and left his, you know, went on a walk, you know, and missed around and got captured because he had done it before. Do you think there's any credibility to those arguments?
I would say without a doubt that they're all being misled, or they just don't have an idea of what's going on. As we stated at the top of the show, part of what we do is military and law enforcement training. I have personal friends that were stationed at that outpost when this went down. I've spoke to every one of them. As a matter of fact, on the day they announced the trade, if you go on my Facebook page, I actually had a flyer for a charity event for Master Sergeant Mark Allen, who was actually on one of the details that was searching for him and was hit by an enemy sniper and is permanently disabled because of this. And it was just coincidental that the day of his charity event was the same day they announced this release. So it was quite an emotional time for all of us, but I've since taken the time to talk to dozens of people. And matter of fact, as recent as yesterday, I was speaking with someone who was stationed at that base and was inside of Bergdahl's tent where he was supposed to be at, saw his gear, saw his kit, you know, his weapon, his ammo. So whether or not he walked off before in the past, that really doesn't excuse, you know, it doesn't excuse the behavior.
Right.
You know, and like I said, these are guys that you know, I trust. All their details, and I talked to guys from three separate units, you know, that aren't getting together and telling their story. I mean, you know, and all of the details line up.
Well, you know, you have this story that was done in Rolling Stone by Michael Hastings. You know,
mm-hmm.
who's since been, you know, killed, and there's all this other controversy of other reasons why Michael Hastings died. You know, the Occupy movement was a very big supporter of all his journalism and whatnot. That, you know, there's information to say, well, Bergdahl was disillusioned because he came from this unit that, from what they described, was more or less an F-troop type of unit. I don't know, you know, some of our younger listeners may not remember the television show F-Troop, but that's not
yeah.
a good thing to be called, you know, being F-Troop. You know, they was a bunch of goof-ups. They were a bunch of black sheep. There was actually a case of one of the soldiers a couple of months before the Bergdahl incident that had ran over an Afghani child with a truck. And so we have to, you know, and they say there's just a lot of different things about that unit that may have, you know, that may call their credibility into question. Have you talked to those guys, and have they said anything about those charges made against their unit?
No, well, the guys that I spoke with weren't actually in his unit. They were just stationed at the same base. And you were in the service. You understand how that works.
Right.
You know, as a matter of fact, the majority of the ones that I spoke with were actually coming in. They'd only been on that post a few weeks, and they were still doing handovers. So they weren't stationed with him, you know, in the months prior to that. They were only there for a few weeks. So what happened prior to that, you know, if he had an issue with it, you know, there's a chain of command. He could have rose those issues and went up the chain to go ahead. If a child got injured, you know, of course, we're all sorry for that. But, you know, accidents happened. You know, a war zone is not a friendly place to be. And, to just say that that gives him, you know, an excuse to abandon his post. If he was having mental issues, he could have sectioned out. He could have asked for a compassionate transfer or something. There are ways to go about that to take care of those issues. It still doesn't give you the right to abandon your post. I mean, what if the president's security detail didn't agree with his politics and they just decided they were going to walk away from the White House one day? You know, we sign
yeah,
a contract. We sign a contract that we're supposed
right.
to serve honorably, and we do our job the way that we're supposed to do, regardless of what people around us do. And that's what happened when he walked off base. Our other soldiers went out and searched for him, and we lost lives in the process.
Well, you know, that's another thing that's been questioned. And they were talking about, you know, the numbers that are being given out. Yeah, we all know for definite record say that, you know, men died on operations that took place on, you know, X day, this day, and the other. But a lot of, you know, Pentagon brass are saying that, you know, these missions wasn't necessarily in search for Bergdahl. They were regular missions in which secondary and tertiary objectives where if you came across information or you came across credible leads to execute on those objectives, then they would do so. But that was not the primary objective of the missions in which the guys lost their lives. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I know for a fact when he was when he first was found to be missing, there were they had 100% personnel accounting at the base. They found out that he was missing, and that was due to hearing conversations that they heard the Taliban having. They picked up intercepts on cell phone or radio communications that there was an American out in a nearby village. So at that point, when they found out that he was missing and they went out to search for him, in the initial days, there were, you know, dedicated searches house to house, room to room, looking for this guy. And what that does, you can say, oh, well, he got killed on another mission over here. But what happened is we took resources that would have been allocated to other duties, and we assigned them to that initial search. Now, Outpost Xerok was nearly overrun if they didn't get air support in there, because they took personnel and sent them off base. And the Taliban now knew, instead of having random patrols, they knew that we were searching in a pattern. And when you're in hostile territory, patterns is what gets you killed. So, you know, we took resources away that would have been defending that outpost. Instead, that outpost was overrun, and I know that there were two soldiers that died defending that outpost, and it was a direct result of them reallocating personnel to the search. So whether or not they were specifically on that, you know, on a search or not, it changed the way we were doing business in that region.
Well, you know, as a serviceman, as a veteran myself, and I've been, you know, not situations that just that bad, and I got one particular situation in hand, but we were trained, you know, irregardless of what our guys did. You went out and got your man. I remember an incident when I was out to sea on board Eisenhower back in the 1990s. We had a guy got a Dear John letter, and he went overboard. He jumped. I mean, we had,
right,
had the guy on watch. We knew he was distraught, but nobody didn't think the guy was going to jump. So he ran off of the ship in the middle of the night and jumped into the Adriatic. We put two birds in the air, a motor whale boat, and we put swimmers in the water. Now, this guy here, was getting all the help that the Navy could give us, but we were still obligated to go out there and look for him. Now, we put swimmers in danger because this was, you know, early spring in the Adriatic. You know, the waters is kind of cold up in that area.
Oh, yeah.
And we put swimmers in the water, but we recovered the guy's body. We never did. But we were obligated because he was one of our brothers, regardless of how, whatever mental condition he went in, we were obligated to go after him. So at the same time, don't you feel like we were obligated to go after, you know, Bird Dog, you know, even though he was having, you know, maybe a mental moment or whatever, that was our duty to go after our brother, you know, try to bring him back and get him some help.
Right. Well, first off, I'll address the mental issue. There's a lot that goes to showing that this was premeditated. Now, whether that was caused by a mental issue or not, he wasn't asking for help for his mental issues. He had sent his gear home. He had asked questions of his leadership beforehand. What would happen if my kit went missing? What would happen if my weapon went missing? Several people have come out and said, and of course, you know, we can't verify these, but several people have come out and said, you know, that he had talked about going off, wandering off in the mountains and getting lost and things like that. Looking back in hindsight, you can link the pieces together. But it shows that there was a pattern that, you know, he was actively seeking to do this. Now, outside of that, of course we had the responsibility to go out and look for him and the duty to go out and look for him. And I'm not questioning that. I'm not saying we shouldn't have went and searched for him. But in that search, the men that lost their lives and the men that were injured, there's a direct cause for that. They would have been in another place at another time, and maybe some of them would have been injured somewhere else on another mission. But we allocated a lot of resources and a lot of manpower to this, and we set ourselves up by performing predictable, you know, situations for the Taliban to take advantage of. In the days immediately following that, like I said, the Taliban ramped up. They knew that we were going to be leaving base to go search from somewhere else, and several of our outposts were attacked. One of them was nearly overrun. So, again, I'm not saying we shouldn't have got him. I'm glad that he's back. I'm happy for his family that they know their son is safe and that he's back home. I'm not shirking that off at all. I wish that we could bring home every soldier that we've ever sent out. But, he needs to come back and not be hailed as a hero for walking off base. If he had a you mentioned earlier Edward Snowden, we have Manning. There's several other guys that, you know, have been termed whistleblowers or things like that. They're not being hailed as a hero. So why are we saying that this guy, you know, if he would have went up the chain and complained, maybe we wouldn't even be talking about him as a hero, but he wouldn't have put other people's lives in jeopardy.
Yes, well, speaking, you know, and that, you know, and I know you've had a lot to say about this one particular issue, or well, the two issues that they kind of go hand in hand. The one that he got the promotion,
right,
and then the pay. Now,
right.
I understood the promotion part. I understood that. We didn't, you know, if he was legitimately got captured, this, that, and the other, you don't want a guy missing out on the, you know, the chances of advancing because he was being held in, you know, held in captivity. I also have some dealings with the back pay, and I would hold it until we got through with an investigation. You know, I don't know how you feel about the promotion per se, but I do, you know, I know how you feel about the promotion. But the pay deal, what do you think about the pay deal?
On the pay and the promotion, I believe with the evidence, there was an investigation that the government did in this back in 2009, and they concluded that he deserted his post. They never closed it out because there was no, you know, we never found him. There was no way to, you know, to just go ahead and say firmly that this was it. But that was the determination of that report, you know, that investigation, was that he did desert his post. So at that point, I would say when he comes back, then you know, give him his base housing, give him whatever salary that you think he's, you know, if he's been promoted from special, you know, from PSC to specialist, now he's a sergeant, give him that pay grade, you know, just like anybody else, monthly, like he should be getting. While that investigation is going on, I'm not saying he should come back here and he should be penniless. Bring him back and give him, you know, from the day he arrives back on base, give him his pay for that, and have the investigation, wrap it up in a speedy manner, get the politics out of it, let the military do their job and do the investigation, and then if he's found, you know, not guilty, go ahead and give him his bonus check, give him his, you know, give him everything he's entitled to. But if he is found, you know, to be guilty, then you know, We haven't given him the money, and now we're chasing it to get it back.
Right.
I just think, you know, if you go back to like your insurance company, if a car gets stolen and there's a question about whether it was, you know, some kind of odd circumstances, they don't just cut you a check. They do an investigation, and then when it's done, they give you the money. So let's say he's owed $200,000 right now. They could put that into some kind of an escrow account, let it earn interest, whatever, and you know, take 6 months or whatever it takes to get this investigation done, and then the money's there waiting on him. And if it's not, the taxpayers aren't out paying for somebody. All these things, I believe we're a nation of laws, and I believe that, you know, we try and do the right thing. But when there's so much evidence and so many stories going to the other way, I haven't heard any soldiers that served with him that have come out and said, everybody's wrong, you know. It's all the politicians and the talking heads and the news correspondents that are saying maybe there's another story out here. So when you look at all that, the firsthand accounts support that he was a deserter. And even if he wasn't sympathetic to the Taliban or whatever, he walked off his post. Right there makes him a deserter. So at that point, I say we hold off on everything and you know, err on the side of caution.
Now, what do you feel about all the attacks? Because, I mean, now, you know, in the part that you talked about, I've been, you know, I can understand. But the thing that has really just burnt me up has been the attacks that people have made on his family, you know, and the mean-spiritedness that we have surrounding this. I mean, understanding, you know, and I understand that the guy that deserted his post, then, yeah, he needs to be dealt with. But people talking about he needs to be shot. When we hadn't shot but one individual in modern U.S. history for desertion, and that one guy was in World War II, and they said he was a chronic deserter, which they had to go get him, bring him back, and he was just one of those people that they said, you know what, Eisenhower said, make an example out of this guy, and I'm going to shoot him because he's just the worst of the worst, you know. And people are, again, attacking his father for still wearing the beard and the fact that both of them are learned push to and this, that, and the other. I mean, what do you think about the veracity of the attacks that have been taking place lately?
Well, you know, to a certain extent, I understand the emotions, But first off, let's go back. You know, this was never declared a war. You know, we've never declared war in Afghanistan because we're not at war with the Afghanis. We're at war with the Taliban, and they're an entity without a home. You know, there's no state government that we can go after. So since it was never declared a war, death isn't on the table just for the charge of being a deserter. So now he could be imprisoned for life, but death is off the table. Now, if we find out that he actually was sympathetic and gave intelligence information to the Taliban, that changes the story. So the people that are saying, you know, he should just be shot on sight, this and the other, line up a firing squad. Again, I'll go back to we're a nation of laws. Let's follow the investigation through and be reasonable about it and figure out what the actual punishment should be. Death threats to his family, I'm against that in any case, you know. But you look at society, and we've gone to a cultural change where that's commonplace now. I'm big into gun rights, and I've seen people say, you know, from an anti-gun standpoint, I wish I could get a gun and shoot you so that you'd know what it felt like. I don't understand that behavior, okay? I can't say I have empathy for that. But at the same time, look at what the White House is doing. We've had White House spokesmen come out and slander the soldiers. There was a series of tweets the other day that you might have seen that said, well, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, what if it was an F troop? You know, the tweet said, well, what if you were in a unit that was filled with psychopaths and bad leadership? Maybe that would convince you to walk off base. Is it legal? No, but maybe you could justify it. But then it went on further. By the time you got down to about the third tweet, they were just slandering the soldiers that served with him by saying maybe the reason that they're saying he was a deserter is to back up themselves, you know, so that to take the issue off of them. And so I look at it from both ways. I don't think a private citizen, we have the right to free speech. If they want to say something about their parents, we can't stop them from saying it. Is it sensational or is it irrational? Yeah, we could argue that. But when you have politicians and you have, you know, White House correspondents coming out and casting our soldiers' service in a negative light, and it goes back to doing the hostage trade, trading five Taliban commanders for somebody that might have been a deserter, you know, negotiating with terrorists. We've done so many things that run counter to what our longstanding policy has been. I think that the politicians need to just say, hey, you know, we're going to wait for the investigation, see what comes out, and let it drop at that. But everybody, it seems, is trying to get their couple of minutes in front of a camera.
Well, you know, and speaking of the trade, I mean, you know, now the big issue on the left has been, you know, okay, we tried to trade five Taliban for this guy. But then we go back to Ronald Reagan and we get talking about missiles being sold to the Iranians and us taking the money and throwing it into the Contras. And both groups were considered, you know, terrorists, and we were supporting them in both cases. I mean, so you got people on both sides of the aisle and they're saying, okay, but nobody can't throw stones in glass houses. There's been administrations over time that have just, you know, have deviated from those policies when they deemed it to be necessary, because it's not like it's written in law that we can't negotiate. You know, that we can't negotiate with a partner. And like one general said, he said, how can you expect to end a war without start talking to people and making some trades? And we're at the end of a war. So, you know, on that hand, I don't know if I would trade five of them, but I would have definitely negotiated, particularly for any soldier I would have. I would negotiate. I don't know if I'd have gave up five Taliban, but I would have negotiated for them. And if it was, and the Israelis, the same thing, which we know are really tough on terrorism, they're good for giving back Palestinian prisoners for a couple of their soldiers. So I don't really see where that been such a crime per se.
Well,
I'm
not going to say it's a crime, and I'm not going to say we shouldn't try and negotiate, but from my standpoint, I say if you're going to negotiate, then negotiate. You know, did we offer, and Ollie North actually mentioned this, and people all chewed his head off because, oh, it's Ollie North and we're back to Iran-Contra. You know, this administration especially was brought up, you know, the whole pitch was that we're going to change the way things are done and this and that and the other. So that's great. If that's what's really going to happen, then you know, then fine. So let's stop going back and comparing it to past administrations and justifying, well, Reagan did Iran-Contra, and, you know, Clinton had a chance to get bin Laden in Sudan and let him go. You know, let's just hold this decision by itself. And what did we negotiate? They've been asking for those same five people for as long as they've been in captivity, and we gave them those five people. Why not make it a one-for-one trade, or why not say, well, you know, we're pulling out, we're going to leave you a fleet of Humvees, or we're going to build a hospital in your village, or whatever it is. And Ollie North asked, was there money, did money exchange hands? Was there anything else? And everybody just shut it up, and that's not even on the table. The discussion has been either or. Did we leave him there and let him die, or did we give him the five commanders? And I think that was a bad move. I think that we should have negotiated for something else, especially for a soldier where we've had a previous investigation that said that he was a deserter. If it was somebody that was captured, you know, like when Jessica Lynch was captured, you know, I can see it in certain circumstances, in one where it looks like the preponderance of evidence says that this happened, and we've had so many soldiers killed. I think that was a bad move. On top of all that, even if it was the right move, look at the you know, and Obama signed this just last year that we would notify Congress and give them 30 days to review the information, and we didn't do that. And even Dianne Feinstein has come out and said this week that she has not seen any evidence that shows that he was in imminent danger and that we couldn't have had that 30-day window. And Dianne Feinstein has been very supportive of this president. So it's not a – I'm not saying it from a political standpoint. I'm saying that, you know, we have laws in place and we have policies in place and checks and balances. And to just go ahead and make this trade and everybody hears about it afterwards, you know, the Senate Intelligence Committee didn't hear about it. I just think it was a bad move to make it, you know, for the president to go ahead unilaterally and just say, we're going to go ahead and do this.
Well, you know, I don't deny that part that he did sign the law. And, you know, me and you both agree on that. We are a nation of laws and not of men. And I wish they had it. I don't know if 30 days would have been, you know, sufficing. And I would have never given myself. You know, I would have never signed a law that would have made me give anybody 30 days or anything, knowing that how the world operates, you need to make decisions pretty
quickly.
Well,
the thing is, we didn't even have 24 hours. The trade was
right.
A done deal when people started, you know,
when
they found out. So, you know, get your intelligence committee together and you know, say, look, we're going to hold a special hearing, bring the Senate Intelligence Committee in, sit there, you know, order some pizza and stay there all night, until you talk it out and you come to a vote and make a decision, and maybe that takes 8 hours, maybe it takes 24 or whatever, but this was done within the inner circle. Qatar,
right.
Qatar knew about it. Qatar was negotiating the agreement. So when Qatar started to negotiate the agreement, why didn't we come out then and say, you know, Qatar's looking at this and seeing if we can negotiate it. If they get this done, you know, where's our line in the sand? What are we going to do? And none of that ever happened. And I think there were ulterior motives to getting this done.
Well, I wish we had more time. And you talked about this earlier in the week about this show being 30 minutes long, which we're going to have to do something about extending that, because we're down to the last 30 seconds, and I really thank you for coming on. We didn't get a chance to talk about Edward Snowden. So
we'll pick up where we left off.
That's exactly what we'll do. We'll do a part two next week. That's a good idea. We'll do a part two next week. And we can go ahead and finish out this conversation. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Jim, and I'll talk to you again next week. And everybody, this is Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith, and hope to hear you have you online with us next week at 1:30. Good evening, everyone.
Take care.